This critique examines Money, Scarcity, and Violence, a comprehensive white paper that analyzes how monetary architectures function as institutional gates to survival rather than neutral coordination utilities, and proposes a viability-oriented redesign based on real physical and ecological constraints. And jumping right in, the proposed transition pathways offer a logical sequence for reform, but the analysis of how to navigate inevitable political and market backlash could be significantly deepened to ensure the framework's real-world resilience.
Yeah, I'm really glad we're starting right there with the transition pathways, because the core theory here is incredibly robust, right? The material lays out this genuinely compelling sequence transition.
Right. Moving from de-weaponizing essential survival goods in phase one.
Exactly. All the way to embedding strict ecological accounting in phase four. It's a massive undertaking. But the weakness here, where I see a gap, is in how statically it treats the political economy obstacles and external constraints over in sections 9.2 and 9.4.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the risk matrix in Appendix D, the author certainly identifies capital flight and governance capture as potential hurdles.
They do, yeah.
But the text lacks a real exploration of the speed, the severity, and the dynamic nature of global financial retaliation. It essentially assumes this somewhat linear progression of political will that might completely unravel the moment an immediate, coordinated market shock hits.
Let's unpack the reality of that market shock. Because we are talking about a global financial architecture that historically reacts quite violently to even minor deviations from orthodox fiscal policy.
Oh, totally.
If a sovereign nation suddenly announces it's going to systematically redesign money to bypass traditional scarcity metrics, capital markets aren't just going to sit back, observe, and wait for phase two.
No, they'll actively try to price the reforming nation out of existence. It's the classic bond vigilante scenario. Institutional investors will dump sovereign debt, spike bond yields, short the domestic currency.
Just to force the government back into austerity before the reform even gets off the ground.
Exactly. Think about recent history where countries tried to implement even mild redistributive policies or even just unorthodox tax cuts, and the bond markets nearly collapsed their pension systems in a matter of days.
That is the exact historical reality this paper needs to confront head on. If a purely orthodox move can trigger a margin call cascade, a fundamental redesign of money will trigger a full-scale financial siege. So my suggestion here is to strengthen this section by shifting from a passive risk assessment to introducing a dynamic stress test.
I like that.
Yeah, a simulated scenario of a nation attempting these reforms while under active financial assault. By anticipating these aggressive countermoves from global financial markets and entrenched rentian interests, the framework can actually provide proactive defensive strategies rather than just, you know, listing potential risks.
I'd love to see what that looks like in practice. For instance, what if the author integrated a historical or hypothetical case study detailing exactly what happens when a country hits phase three, reorienting credit and rent structures, and immediately faces a massive sovereign bond sell-off or severe currency dumping?
Mapping out the week-by-week or even day-by-day escalation of that kind of attack would be incredibly clarifying. It takes the theory and battle-tests it.
Right.
And taking that further, the text mentions regional clearing arrangements in Section 9.4 as a mitigation strategy. Instead of just a passing mention, a concrete example would be an explicit breakdown of how a coalition of states builds a financial firewall before initiating phase two, which is where they aim to replace the orthodox discipline mechanism.
So, you're talking about detailing the mechanics of how those states shield each other's currencies. When external markets attempt to short one nation's currency into submission, how do the allied central banks coordinate swap lines or alternative clearinghouses to absorb that shock?
Exactly. The transition isn't just a policy rollout, it's a defensive campaign. And another crucial concrete example of that defense would be drafting a specific sequence of capital control mechanisms that need to be legally pre-positioned before the provisioning floor is fully secured.
That makes a lot of sense. You have to lock the doors before you start remodeling the house.
Right.
If you don't have those legal and financial capital controls sequenced properly, like statutory powers to freeze outbound speculative flows while keeping trade channels open for essential imports like food and energy, the state gets bankrupted by capital flight before the transition even gets off the ground.
And if the civilizational viability this paper aims for is destroyed by a market shock in month two, the theoretical elegance of the four phases won't matter at all.
Not at all.
Showing the legal and financial sequence of those capital controls gives policymakers a tangible roadmap and really grounds the ambition of the paper in the gritty reality of geopolitics.
And that real-world geopolitical G-grit you just mentioned actually ties perfectly into the next issue with the paper. The three-step constraint diagnostic is a powerful conceptual tool, yet it remains somewhat abstract without a fully developed real-world application to anchor its utility for policymakers.
The conceptual framework itself is fantastic. I mean, Section 7 brilliantly delineates physical, ecological, and institutional constraints, and Appendix C provides a really clean flowchart model to separate them out.
It does.
But the weakness, the disconnect, happens when we look at the illustrative domains provided, things like housing and healthcare. They're generalized hypotheticals.
Yeah, the vulnerability in the text is that it relies on those generalized examples for an audience that already comprehends the high-level theory. The reader already knows the theoretical difference between an institutional rule and a physical limit. They don't need a hypothetical primer.
Exactly.
The lack of applied, hard data leaves this central diagnostic tool feeling a bit unmoored from the gritty realities of actual policy drafting.
It's the difference between explaining the physics of a combustion engine and actually driving a car in heavy traffic. The logic is sound, but how does the diagnostic handle messy, conflicting real-world statistics? If we want a skeptical policymaker or a hostile finance minister to accept this diagnostic, they need to see undeniable proof that it works on a current, localized, and highly contested issue.
So the suggestion here is to apply the three-step constraint diagnostic to a specific, contemporary, and highly recognizable economic crisis, utilizing real macroeconomic and ecological data to walk the reader through the exact friction points.
Let's picture how that actually plays out in the text. As a concrete example, you could take the current housing crisis in a hyper-financialized city, let's say London or San Francisco, and run the actual numbers through the diagnostic to diagnose why affordable housing isn't being built.
Okay, so for step one, the real resource test, the author wouldn't just say, look for available labor and materials. They would document the exact number of idle construction workers, the tons of available local steel, and the thousands of vacant residential units sitting empty as speculative assets in London right now.
Yes, ground it in undeniable statistics. And then for step two, the ecological ceiling test. They would pull local environmental data, comparing the carbon and ecological impact of new suburban builds versus retrofitting those existing vacant structures in the city center.
Which leads perfectly to step three, the institutional rule test. Instead of a vague mention of rules, the paper would identify the specific zoning laws, tax incentives favoring speculative vacancy, or local councils' fiscal deficit rules that are currently acting as the artificial barrier, preventing those idle workers from retrofitting those vacant units.
When you map it out with actual data like that, it transforms the diagnostic from a neat academic concept into a devastating critique of current policy. It takes the text's core thesis that scarcity is often a deliberate institutional design choice and makes it visible.
Definitely.
Are there other areas where this applied approach would work just as well?
Energy is perfect for this. Another concrete example would be for the author to model a recent failure in energy transition provisioning. We've all watched a legislative debates where politicians throw their hands up and claim a nation simply cannot afford to upgrade its electrical grid.
Which is a classic example of conflating a step three institutional constraint, like a self-imposed fiscal debt ceiling, with a step one physical constraint, pretending the nation doesn't have the physical capacity to do the work.
Exactly. The paper could use quotes from actual legislative debates alongside hard data on available solar panel supply chains, local copper reserves, and idle electrical engineering labor. By contrasting the political rhetoric of scarcity with the hard physical data of abundance, the author demonstrates precisely how using this specific framework would have explicitly changed the legislative outcome.
It also provides a ready-made template. If a staffer in a mayor's office reads the applied London housing example, they instantly know how to pull the equivalent data for their own jurisdiction and run the exact same diagnostic to justify a new viability-oriented policy.
Right.
But getting them to actually use that tool in public brings up another massive hurdle, which is the cultural narrative surrounding all of this.
That leads us right into the final piece of the puzzle. While the paper excellently diagnoses the psychological and cultural stabilization of scarcity, the strategy for countering these deep-seated narratives requires a more practical, applied rhetorical toolkit.
The diagnosis itself is flawless. Section 6 thoroughly explains the cognitive conflation of institutional rules with physical limits. It perfectly articulates how the household budget analogy paralyzes public understanding.
It really does. Every politician on earth loves comparing national debt to a household checking account.
And it's incredibly sticky because, as the paper points out, it activates ancient neural circuits associated with survival threat.
Right. But the weakness I'm seeing here is that while the author perfectly diagnoses why we're culturally hardwired to panic about scarcity, they don't give reformers the actual tools to fight that panic on a debate stage. In Section 8.8, the primary solution offered is a constraint dashboard to increase public literacy. But a dashboard alone, no matter how transparent or beautifully designed, is not going to dismantle an evolutionary, culturally embedded fear of instability.
You cannot bring a spreadsheet to a primal emotional fight. If we accept the paper's brilliant premise that scarcity-gated systems endure because they activate a deep-seated survival threat, then our counter-messaging has to operate on that exact same psychological level. The author leaves the reformers without the actual rhetorical bridges necessary to sell this architecture in a hostile media environment.
To fix that, my suggestion is that the author should develop a specific communication and framing framework that reform-minded policymakers can immediately adopt to systematically replace orthodox economic metaphors in the public sphere. The entire focus must be on framing the transition so it triggers psychological security rather than activating the evolutionary scarcity sensitivity detailed in the text.
I want to visualize what that toolkit contains. One incredibly powerful concrete example would be adding a dedicated table of replacement metaphors.
So, explicitly outlining how to pivot a debate away from the orthodox household checkbook metaphor.
Right. You replace it with something like a public utility engineering metaphor. When a journalist asks the inevitable question, "How will you pay for it?" the toolkit provides the advocate with a rehearsed, psychologically secure pivot. Instead of getting bogged down in tax and spend debates, they pivot to, "The real question is, how do we mobilize our idle resources safely without exceeding our ecological limits?" You give them the exact words.
What about the constraint dashboard itself? How can we make that more than just an informational spreadsheet?
Another concrete example would be designing a hypothetical mock-up of it right there in the paper, but treating it as a psychological tool rather than just a data portal. Detail exactly which three metrics should be on the front page to maximize impact. For instance, placing unused productive capacity directly next to unmet essential need.
The visual contrast there would be striking. You show the thousands of empty homes right next to the number of the unhoused population. The psychological reasoning is to immediately and visually shatter the illusion of physical scarcity the moment a citizen looks at the dashboard. It forces the viewer to confront the artificiality of the scarcity.
It short-circuits the household budget panic because it shows the physical reality. Another area where precise vocabulary is absolutely crucial is the rollout of the provisioning floor.
Yes, if you roll out a revolutionary provisioning floor but use traditional bureaucratic welfare language, it's dead on arrival.
Completely. So a final concrete example for the toolkit is proposing specific narrative framing that intentionally distances the provisioning floor from highly stigmatized, means-tested welfare terminology.
Framing it instead as civilizational infrastructure or baseline utility rights. By explicitly designing the vocabulary, you bypass existing cultural violence narratives that paint social support as dependency or a burden on the taxpayer.
We have to recognize that the narrative is just as structural as the monetary policy itself. If you successfully change the rules of credit allocation, but continue to use the language of austerity, obligation, and taxpayer burden, the system will eventually revert to scarcity gating. The cultural expectations simply haven't shifted. Equipping the reader with this rhetorical toolkit ensures the structural changes can actually be defended and sustained in the court of public opinion.
That brings us to the close with our analysis today. To recap, our critique focused on three high-level structural opportunities to elevate this already outstanding white paper. First, we looked at stress testing the transition pathways against market shocks, like bond vigilante attacks, to ensure real-world resilience.
Second, we examined grounding the constraint diagnostic in real-world contemporary data to transition the framework from the theoretical realm to the undeniably practical, moving away from generalized hypotheticals.
And finally, we discussed operationalizing the counter-narratives to overcome the cultural inertia and evolutionary psychology that stabilizes artificial scarcity.
To summarize the actionable suggestions you can implement, simulate a dynamic market retaliation scenario to formulate defensive financial strategies and pre-positioned capital controls. Apply the three-step diagnostic to a concrete modern crisis, like regional housing or energy transitions, using real macroeconomic data. And develop a precise rhetorical toolkit featuring replacement metaphors to systematically dismantle the household budget analogy in public discourse.
We highly encourage you to implement these high-level structural enhancements. This material is incredibly vital, and refining these areas will maximize its impact on policy and governance. Please submit the revised material back to the shell for further constructive feedback. We would love to see how this architecture evolves.